executive order aimed at cracking down on big tech firms and promoting competition. Now, basically, he said capitalism without competition, well, that isn't capitalism. It's exploitation. And the problems to have come out of big tech, these are some of them. Personal information gathering. You have buying up of potential competitors and competing unfairly with small businesses. That's actually a good topic for our next program. Tell us what you think. Moving on to the Vatican, Holy Vatican. You have a major problem there. There was some news that obviously taints its holy image. A judge indicting 10, including a cardinal, for alleged financial crimes. The Vatican judge ordered 10 people, including an Italian cardinal, to stand trial for alleged crimes. Now, it included embezzlement, money laundering, fraud, extortion, and the abuse of office, as if sex abuse scandals were not enough for the Vatican. Moving on to our next topic, West Asia Daesh alert is now in effect. Poverty and inequality is actually paving the way for these Daesh terrorists to resurge in Syria and in Iraq. Now, the U.S. has issued this warning that Daesh is seeking to exploit dire economic conditions to reconstitute its presence in the region. Well, the question isn't the rise of Daesh and economic insecurity a result of U.S. war, occupation, and presence in the region, not to mention the U.S. support for the group? Something to think about. Finally, a hunger reality check in effect here. When it comes to COVID-19 and death, Oxfam has stated that a year and a half since COVID-19, deaths from hunger are actually outpacing the virus. Some of the reasons: ongoing conflict, economic disruptions of the pandemic, and an escalating climate crisis have pushed millions more people into extreme levels of food insecurity. We'll stop for a quick break here on Economic Divide, but don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Time now for our in-depth section, where we take a deeper look into the topic of this program. Now, this segment we have called the Failure to Act segment, in reference to what if the U.S. does not play catch-up and spend the money or enough money on its infrastructure? Well, the American Society of Civil Engineers actually issues a report with the same name, Failure to Act. And this is what the infographic looks like. We're going to take a look at what happens over the next 20 years. Now, over this time span, the overdue infrastructure bill will cost the average American household $3,300 per year. Now, it states that things like poor roads and airports actually means travel times increase. Now, an aging electric grid and inadequate water distribution makes utilities unreliable. So, problems like these translate into higher costs for businesses to manufacture and to distribute goods and to provide services. Now, these higher costs, in turn, unfortunately then have to get passed on to guess who? Workers and families. Basically, Main Street. Now, if the U.S. does not act by the year 2039 on its poor infrastructure, it is forecast to lose a lot of money. $10.3 trillion in GDP from 2020 through 2039. Now, we already have passed 2020. That's nearly half of the annual U.S. GDP in 2019. Also, $2.4 trillion in exports from 2020 through 2039, or more than half of all the profits of Fortune 500 companies that was generated in 2019. And finally, 3 million jobs. That's two times the number of Walmart employees in the U.S. Now, what is worrying is that it's not as if the U.S. has not spent money on its infrastructure throughout the years. Taking a look at this graph, which starts from the year 2007 and goes to the year 2017, you can see that $450 billion for the year 2007 was spent on U.S. infrastructure. It peaked roughly at around $465 billion, with a low at in the year 2013 of a little bit below $430 billion. Now, let's see what our guest thinks about this. Joining us for this segment is Norman Stockwell. He is a radio host and political commentator. He's also the publisher of the Progressive magazine, which has the slogan, A Voice for Peace and Social Justice, since the year 1909. Okay, Norman, welcome. Taking a look at the report 2021, it's a report card for America's infrastructure. It found U.S.'s infrastructure earned a cumulative grade of C-. Now, reports prior to that actually got grades of D+ on several occasions, with roads, bridges, water infrastructure, and schools to be near destruction, based on what the report said, and dilapidated after years of negligence. So the natural question is, why is the U.S. infrastructure left alone to its demise when the U.S. is spending excessively in other areas like wars, nuclear bombs, military spending, and military assistance to places like Israel?
It's been a very serious problem here in the United States for many years that money has not been invested in infrastructure, and we've seen deterioration in the road system, in the bridges. The last time there were large federal expenditures to build up roads and bridges in the United States, I think, was in the 1960s. And since that time, what we've seen is, particularly with Republicans in power, moving away from supporting infrastructure and also moving towards the privatization of both services and infrastructure systems. And so instead of having government oversight and government funds going into upkeeping the national infrastructure, what you've seen is things being privatized and therefore money not spent by corporations that really look to the bottom line, that look to save a dollar in every place they can. Now, on top of that, the sentiment of the voters has been towards privatization and towards not spending money on projects like infrastructure because they see it as wasteful. So it's been very difficult here in the United States, and I think this is the hurdle that the new Biden administration is facing as they try to implement infrastructure improvement programs.
Very well. Thank you very much for that. Norman, we're going to bring Norman actually back a little bit later into the program. Okay, in our first report, we covered the Florida building collapse and how it points to two major problems. One was how U.S.'s aging high-rises may also be in danger, requiring major renovation and inspection. Well, the next problem, which is a crisis in many respects, is what we just talked about. That points to America's infrastructure problem.
Some of that work involves building our country's infrastructure. America's roads, bridges, dams, highways, and ports, they're critical to our nation's success.
Trillions of dollars in taxpayers' money. U.S.'s failing infrastructure, a major concern for decades. Each president has come and gone, promising to spend billions and even trillions of dollars on it.
Every president over the past four or five presidents has talked about doing a big infrastructure package. You may recall that President Trump proposed a $2 trillion infrastructure package.
The current U.S. president originally proposed $1.9 trillion, but got half of that.
We had a really good meeting, and answered a direct question, we have a deal. And I think it's really important. We've all agreed that none of us got what we wanted. I clearly didn't get all I wanted. They gave more than I think maybe they were inclined to give in the first place.
The American Society of Civil Engineers grades U.S.'s infrastructure every 4 years, and the U.S. has barely made it above the D range.
Now, the American Society of Civil Engineers gives America's infrastructure a poor grade. One out of every 5 miles of highway pavement is in bad condition.
We have 16 categories of infrastructure. We put together a pool of experts, about 30 different civil engineers who are analyzing. A lot of it is data that's available through the federal government. So we're looking at aviation, bridges, roads, transit, dams, levees, schools, parks, solid waste, drinking water, wastewater. So all of these different categories are analyzed. Unfortunately, 12 out of the 16 categories are in the D range, which is poor or at risk, which is really reflecting a lot of our infrastructure being at the end of its useful life.
The problem is time. Roadways and bridges are still in use decades after the end of their lifespans. Sewer and water systems are decaying, and a changing climate has added to the wear and tear.
You've heard and reported that in Miami-Dade County, there's what's called a 40-year recertification for 40-year-old buildings. That only exists in two counties in Florida, Miami-Dade and Broward, which is essentially Fort Lauderdale and its surroundings. Why not a statewide standard? Why 40 years? Perhaps it should be 30 or 20 years or periodically.
We led the world in the middle of the 20th century. We led the world.
The U.S. president, however, is pushing for two infrastructure bills. Beside one on buildings, he also wants to invest in human infrastructure, like in preschool and higher education. His reason? To ensure U.S. global leadership in the face of the rising power from China.
In fact, it's the largest American jobs investment since World War II. It will create millions of jobs, good-paying jobs. We'll grow the economy, make us more competitive around the world, promote our national security interests, and put us in a position to win the global competition with China.
He recently said that China is going full bore and has left the U.S. far behind in dollars spent on research and development. He also said a giant infrastructure revamp would send a signal to ourselves and to the world that American democracy can work and deliver for the people.
In 2008, the proposition came out and California voted to have high-speed rail started. We're seeing the product of that. A lot of men and women are coming out here and working on that, and we're finally pushing something out.
It was just a big mess, and it still is. It's unorganized. If we have to call somebody, they're not going to be there right now. They either quit or got fired, or it's just a big unorganized mess, and they know it.
Okay, time now to get both guests in this section to see what their thoughts are on the next question and compare it with each other. Greg Carroll from the International Action Center rejoins us along with Norman Stockwell, who's a radio host and political commentator. All right, first let me start with you, Norman Stockwell. The U.S. President Joe Biden has gotten an agreement with the Republicans for $1.2 trillion out of the $2 trillion that he had requested for the infrastructure spending, building on top of what his predecessor, the former U.S. President Donald Trump, started. But even that amount appears not to be enough. One report said, in addition to grading 17 categories of infrastructure, the report found $2.59 trillion investment gap over 10 years between what the U.S. currently projected to spend and what it must spend to bring systems back to a state of good repair. So where does that leave Biden? Sounds like some hard choices actually need to be made. After all, people's lives and health are at risk here.
Well, I think the Biden administration initially pushed for a very broad infrastructure bill and a significant amount of spending. And the Republicans in Congress have fought back against that, not only in terms of the amount of spending, but in terms of the places that that money would be spent. I think it's very important to note that in the original Biden proposal, the discussion was of having internet access for everyone, being a part of basic infrastructure, having child care support and health care and so on. All of these things that really are part of the infrastructure of a society, even if they're not physical things like bridges or roads. The Republicans have argued for a much more narrow definition of infrastructure to be those specific bricks and mortar items, if you will, like the repair of roads or bridges.
And Carol, we'd like to ask you about this 2021 report card that came out from the Engineers for America's Infrastructure, which gave the U.S. a grade of C-. Now, prior to that, a grade of D, D-plus was issued on several occasions, and you had the same old problems that covered things like roads, bridges, water infrastructure, for example, or even schools that are near destruction. Why do you think the U.S. infrastructure is left to the state that it is, money not being spent on it, administration after administration, when, again, you have things that the money is going to, like military spending, like nuclear weapons, in the trillions of dollars, practically?
Yeah, the U.S. is the richest country in the history of the world, and there's no reason why with infrastructure, you know, things like roads, bridges, buildings, schools, all of this, you know, there's no reason that they should be in the state of disrepair that they are, and that there's tragedies like what happened in Miami and similar, you know, scenes that we're seeing even just this past few weeks all across the country where, you know, in New York City, for example, the subway system there was totally flooded, you know, when there was a flash flood storm that came through. You know, there's wildfires out west, and there's, you know, incredibly historic heat affecting, you know, tens, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people across this country. And it really comes down to the U.S. is much more interested in profit and protecting the its interests abroad by pouring hundreds of billions or over $1 trillion into the military, by giving tax breaks to the rich. And, you know, there's many municipalities across the country who will give also these massive handouts to these corporations, on the promise of bringing jobs and things like this, so that they'll build and relocate, you know, their company headquarters or this or that operation to their city. Meanwhile, you know, the wear and tear that that takes on the infrastructure in those places is passed off, you know, to working class people. And so, you know, ultimately the U.S. is much more interested in protecting the rich, in protecting the rich and their interests abroad than they are about, you know, doing the very meager things that would ensure, you know, a good, secure, and safe life for, you know, the majority of working class people in this country.
The story of the U.S. infrastructure to be in such a sad state, well, it's a sad story. It's basically misappropriating funds, that's right, to areas where American lives are not as important as, let's say, in the area of military spending or wars. I mean, it's quite ironic that the U.S. actually says that the military spending is for national security's sake, to protect American lives. Yet at home, people are losing their lives due to poor infrastructure, from roads to tainted water to bridges to you name it. That does it for this edition of Economic Divide. Your questions and comments are always welcome. From Mikovit Tafoye and the entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Atmospheric measurements show that deforestation and rapid local warming have reduced or eliminated the capacity of the eastern Amazonian forest to absorb carbon dioxide, with worrying implications for future global warming. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Scott Denning, author. This article is published under the heading, Southeast Amazonia is no longer a carbon sink. Stay tuned for more. Since at least the inception of modern records of atmospheric carbon dioxide levels in 1950s, there has been a small global excess, about 2%, in the amount of CO2 taken up by land plants for photosynthesis, compared with the amount emitted as a result of the decomposition of organic material. This land carbon sink has absorbed around 25% of all fossil fuel emissions since 1960. Offsetting some global warming. Tropical forests have been a major component of the land carbon sink, and the largest intact tropical forest is in Amazonia. Writing in Nature, Gatti et al. Report extensive direct sampling of the atmosphere over this region. Their data revealed that western Amazonia is still a relatively weak carbon sink, but suggests that deforestation and warming over eastern Amazonia have degraded or even reversed regional uptake of carbon by the forest. The sink arises from a combination of the increased vegetation growth that occurs in response to rising levels of CO2 and other nutrients, changes in land management and ecosystem responses to climate change. Tropical forests are Earth's most productive ecosystems, but they're not recovering from past human disturbances their counterparts at mid-latitudes have done, nor are they benefiting from the markedly longer growing seasons associated with climate change, as are boreal and Arctic ecosystems. Carbon has accumulated in the biomass of Amazonian forests for decades, but studies in the past few years suggest that Amazonian carbon sinks are threatened by deforestation and forest degradation, progressive drying of the climate, and fires. However, it is difficult to make direct measurements that reflect the local carbon balance of many Amazonian ecosystems because access to those regions is limited, and it is hard to extrapolate available local data across the whole region because Amazonian ecosystems vary enormously. Satellite measurements of atmospheric levels of CO2 and carbon monoxide, a tracer of combustion, and of solar-induced fluorescence from vegetation, a proxy for photosynthesis, show that the year-to-year carbon balance in Amazonia is quite sensitive to drought and fire. However, persistent cloud cover in this region complicates the acquisition of such measurements, and the collection of these data began only about a decade ago. Direct measurements of the atmosphere could constrain estimates of regional carbon balance, but are sparse for Amazonia. Intergadian colleagues who have directly measured the atmosphere in four regions across Amazonia for 9 years. The authors used aircraft to collect air samples from near the surface up to an altitude of 4.5 kilometers at each region, then analyze the samples to produce a vertical profile of the concentrations of a suit of gases, including CO2 and CO. The authors produced 590 vertical profiles during their study, with a typical sampling period of about twice a month at each region. Gatti et al. Also used data from several sites on remote islands and coastal headlands around the South Atlantic Ocean to establish background concentrations of gases. This allowed them to compute spatial gradients of CO2 and CO concentrations between the background sites in each of the profiled regions in Amazonia. The authors analyzed their data by season and by year and determined how the spatial patterns of CO2 and CO concentrations varied according to the region over which sample there had passed before collection. Finally, they used the seasonal CO2 concentration gradients to estimate regional carbon flux associated with forest growth and decay, and estimated carbon emissions produced by fires from the CO gradients. Northwestern Amazonia is almost always very wet and shows little seasonal variation in growth and decay. Gratti and colleagues' atmospheric profiling indicates that this region was close to carbon balance during the period of the study. About as much carbon was taken up by plants for growth as was emitted from decay processes. However, the moisture and fertility of Amazonian forests changes substantially further south and east. Dry seasons, periods with rainfall of less than 100 millimeters per month, get progressively longer, eventually lasting for 5 months or more as the forest grades into savanna. Gatti and colleagues find that the drier forests in the northeastern and southeastern regions studied were close to carbon balance during the wet season, but that carbon released from decomposition and fire tended to exceed carbon uptake by photosynthesis during the dry season. The observed regional and seasonal patterns of carbon uptake in the Northwest transitioning to carbon release in the drier East were consistent with the year-to-year variability of the data, which revealed that greater carbon releases associated with decomposition and fire occur during hotter and drier years. Gatti and co-workers show that the transition of eastern Amazon forests from carbon sink to carbon source during the dry season is associated with a strong regional warming trends. Eastern Amazon sites have warmed by as much as about 6/10 degrees Celsius per decade during the dry season over the past 40 years. This is more than three times the rate of global warming and about the same rate as for the Arctic. West season and Western Amazonian forests have warmed too, but at a much slower rate. Warming states in dry season for eastern Amazonia might have been amplified by deforestation and forest degradation. Getty et al. Conclude that increases in fires and in physiological stress, mortality, and decomposition of trees in this area are associated with increasing carbon loss from regional ecosystems. The authors have documented the accelerating transition of forests from carbon sinks to sources using direct measurements of larger-scale gradients of atmospheric gas concentrations. The overall pattern of deforestation, warmer and drier dry seasons, drought stress, fire, and carbon release in eastern Amazonia seriously threatens the Amazon carbon sink. Indeed, the results cast doubt on the ability of tropical forests to sequester large amounts of fossil fuel-derived CO2 in the future. For decades, ecologists have been surprised that the fraction of fossil fuel emissions absorbed by land ecosystems has remained fairly constant, even though these emissions have increased. Forests at high latitudes have continued to accumulate carbon because their growing seasons have lengthened as a result of climate change. Mid-latitude forests have done so because they have been recovering from past clearance and because they have benefited from the increased availability of nutrients produced as a result of human activities or mobilized in soils by climate warming. By contrast, increased carbon sequestration by tropical forests must be driven largely by an increase in photosynthesis associated with rising CO2 levels, but regional atmospheric profiling suggests that this carbon sink is threatened by forest degradation and warming. Another complication is that fossil fuel emissions must be quickly reduced to meet international climate targets, but it is not clear how the CO2-driven carbon sinks of tropical forests will respond to a rapidly warming world in which CO2 levels are no longer rising. The future of carbon accumulation in tropical forests has therefore long been uncertain. Getty and colleagues' atmospheric profiles show that the uncertain future is happening now.
Around the world with reporters.
shock has rippled through the Muslim community after the European Union's highest court ruled that businesses can sack Muslim women for wearing the hijab if they work face-to-face with customers or if the wearing of the religious clothing causes workspace conflicts. The ruling was in response to a case brought by two German Muslim female workers who were asked by their employers not to wear Islamic headscarves while at work.
The decision has been met by claims that it will further fuel Islamophobia at this crucial time when countries in Europe such as France and Austria are already eliminating freedoms for Muslims, supposedly to combat extremism.
In Britain, several religious MPs, including Muslims and a Sikh, chastised the court, labelling the ruling as Islamophobic and deeply flawed. In addition, I spoke with a London-based female Muslim media personality about her fears for the future of Muslims in Europe.
To me, I feel oppressed, to be honest, by this decision. And I feel that I am now limited in my identity and my freedom of rights, freedom of belief, all the values that are actually supposedly meant to be Western, modern. Yes, part of it is a symbol of my faith, but it's so much more if you were to really understand what the hijab actually means, or any sort of religious symbol. It is not just coming from one aspect. I think it's really unfair. And it's, again, it is targeting a particular group, especially the Muslim women, because we are the ones that are known to be wearing the headscarf known as the hijab.
Many activists warned that following the niqab ban, European powers would target the hijab next. They were right. But if the battle to protect the hijab is lost, what comes next? Robert Carter, London.
Since the beginning of the Saudi-led war on Yemen, thousands of civilians have lost their limbs, eyes, or got mentally disabled due to the lethal bombardment on civilian facilities. According to the Amnesty International, 4 million people with disabilities in Yemen face multiple challenges, and the number is growing up each year as the war continues.
We feel like there is deliberate negligence by the international organizations towards us, as they have not provided anything so far. This comes as the number of disabled exceeds 4 million, according to the UN organizations. We call on the international organizations to come and see our sufferings. Most of us don't even have a wheelchair.
Yemen's Disabled Care Fund says it provides healthcare services for more than 200,000 disabled, including 50,000 children who are getting educational services as well. However, the fund is suffering from a shortage of money amid the continued absence of related international organizations.
The Disabled Care Fund suffers from many difficulties, including lack of resources. Meanwhile, there is a significant increase in the number of the disabled each year. Sometimes we cannot provide wheelchairs and medicines for some of the disabled. Unfortunately, the international organizations turned a blind eye to this humanitarian catastrophe. We call on all the related international bodies to fulfill their duty towards the disabled Yemenis and provide aid to this vulnerable group.
In late 2015, the Saudi-led coalition has bombed the Anour Center for Care and Rehabilitation of the Blind in Sana'a, inflicting heavy damages on it. Since the beginning of the Saudi war on Yemen in March 2015, the relentless bombardments of the kingdom have killed tens of thousands of civilians, including women and the children.
Besides losing parts of their bodies, millions of people with disabilities are among those most oppressed groups amid what the United Nations has called the world's worst humanitarian crisis. They say the Saudi war and the blockade have turned their lives into a real tragedy. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi arrived in Damascus International Airport. He met with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, who said Syria looks forward to increasing cooperation with China in various domains, praising what he described as China's ethical policies. Assad thanked China for its stances in support of Syria's sovereignty, unity, and independence. Yi expressed his country's interest in Syria's participation in China's Belt and Road Initiative, which is a global infrastructure development strategy adopted by China to invest in nearly 70 countries and international organizations. He asserted that China will continue supporting the Syrian people in the fight on terror, challenging economic sanctions, and standing against foreign intervention.
The visit comes in the framework of ongoing Chinese support to Syria, as well as boosting cooperation in all sectors, especially now that the government controls most of the country. China played a positive role during the war on Syria in support of the legitimate government and the country's independence and stability.
An hour-long meeting was also held between the Chinese foreign minister and his Syrian counterpart, Faisal al-Miqdad, discussing political and economic topics of mutual interest. They agreed to take bilateral cooperation between their countries to a new level for the benefit of both countries' peoples.
The Chinese foreign minister visits Syria amid economic difficulties Syrians are facing due to the sanctions imposed by the U.S. and its allies. The visit is a message from China to the U.S. and the EU that their siege and pressure on Syrians will be broken by China, which is a strong economic power for sure.
During the Chinese official's visit, Syria and China signed two agreements in the economic and medical assistance sectors. China is one of Syria's staunch allies, which vetoed nearly a dozen UN draft resolutions on foreign intervention in Syria since the war started in 2011. The timing of the Chinese foreign minister's visit to Syria is very important for both the Syrian people and the government in light of the harsh economic situation they are living inside the country. China is conveying a message of support, especially in the economic sector, for Syrians. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Accusations of a state-led anti-Palestine crackdown in British schools have been proven true following the release of a case study by Muslim advocacy group CAGE, which details not only the shocking treatment of students who expressed their humanitarian support for Palestine during Israel's recent onslaught, but also that school leaders have received diktats from the government.
These shock findings highlight the extent in which the government seems to be prepared to go in order to stamp out criticism of Israel at every avenue. Even young students are being targeted by the scheme, which appears bent on hampering freedom of speech on this particular issue.
Out of the 47 cases documented, censorship tactics included verbal warnings, suspensions, a student being expelled, and even police intervention and a referral to an anti-terrorism agency. While most of the students' activities involves little more than vocalizing support for Palestine, fundraising, and displaying Palestine flags. CAGE representatives expressed great concern at the toxic influence government watchdogs have in the British education system.
The schools happily endorse and welcome expressions of support for the Black Lives Matter movement. They join in campaigns against Islamophobia, against any sort of racism that exists in society and prejudices, but when it comes to issues of Palestine, it's as though they are blindsided, and they very much become extensions of the policing arm of the state. Schools and school leaders have a duty to foster an environment within their schools that is conducive to civic education and to create students which are active citizens in the future. What schools should not be doing is disciplining students for practicing basic empathy and showing solidarity with oppressed people around the globe.
For adult activists, speaking up for Palestine could see your reputation assassinated. But now, even young, aspiring humanitarians could see their futures dashed simply for speaking out. Robert Carter, London.
Following an easing of restrictions in the EU and UK, coronavirus cases across Western Europe are on a sharp upward curve. The Delta variant, first identified in India and which spreads much more easily, is being blamed.
The world is becoming a village, so people travel, it's hard to contain.
See all the people here, and some people are not that careful, I think, so...
One word for me, go to vaccine.
The vast majority of young adults and children in the EU have not been vaccinated. This is why the virus is moving around so quickly, experts say.
In view of the rapid spread of the highly contagious Delta variant that is raising concerns not only in Europe but also around the globe, it is extremely important to vaccinate, as per national recommendations, as many people in Europe as possible.
Economists say the EU simply cannot afford further lockdowns. Economic forecasts for the 27-nation bloc are positive, but there are a lot of unknowns.
We continue to monitor the situation very closely, and in particular, and obviously, we are monitoring the Delta variant.
The fact that protectionist Donald Trump is no longer in the White House offers some economic hope, senior EU officials are indicating.
In terms of our relationships with the US, we have gone from a winter of discontents to a summer of cooperation.
In several EU nations, including Greece, France and Ireland, young people have staged protests believing they are being forced by governments to take the jab in order to participate in society. We have been getting some views in Belgium.
I mean, it's good that the protest is there, isn't it?
I feel forced to receive something I don't want to receive, be vaccinated or not. So you can't force people to do that.
Health authorities in the EU argue it is important that young people do get vaccinated, claiming they may only develop a mild illness initially with COVID-19, but could ultimately go on to suffer from long COVID, which can have life-changing implications. Campaigners say EU leaders are shooting themselves in the foot by not providing more vaccines to less well-off parts of the world. This could lead to new variants that might be resistant to existing vaccines, they warn. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
As angry mobs block roads and clash with the army, the price of the dollar against the Lebanese lira was skyrocketing, hinting a gloomy outlook in the horizon. In an interview Thursday night, Hariri blamed President Aoun for impeding the cabinet formation process and for his resignation.
The group led by the president has decided not to cooperate with Saad Hariri, and all the obstacles that I have faced are because of that group. I did not want to just negotiate while knowing that I cannot form a cabinet, so I resigned because it seemed to me that President Aoun does not want to form a cabinet.
Presidential office slammed Hariri for his comments, declaring that Hariri was, quote, not ready to discuss amendments of any kind, and closed the door on any talks. Experts see that Hariri is now launching an internal conflict, using resistance as a scapegoat.
It was obvious that he's preparing for his election campaign, because later in his interview yesterday night, he launched his election campaign by opening fire on the resistance in Lebanon.
Observers see that talk of electoral campaigns will be the main focus in the post-Hariri resignation era.
The Americans, they haven't reached a point to let the solution take place. They are still using the financial crisis as a blackmailing means to try to blackmail the resistance in Lebanon.
The state of despair on the streets of Beirut is a reflection of the general situation.
Everyone knew there would not be a new cabinet. The country has collapsed. If the prime minister wanted to actually form a cabinet, he would go for real negotiations. The result will be death of the people, no electricity, no water, and no fuel. Lebanon has fallen.
All the people need to protest. The rich and the poor are equal now, and all six are facing the same crisis.
They all want a piece of cheese for themselves. If they cannot rule right, they should leave. People are helpless. Hunger knows no religion or sect.
With the socioeconomic crisis quickly escalating, many believe the end result will be a probable demise of the entire political system.
French sources described Hariri's move as cynical self-destruction for the political class. Others considered it the start of an electoral campaign. But one thing all sides agree on is that it puts Lebanon in the face of a chaotic period ahead. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
Israel has advanced a major settler building project known as E1. Israel's new prime minister, Naftali Bennett, has relaunched the controversial project for the construction of over 3,412 settler units in the occupied West Bank to connect the largest Israeli settlement of Ma'ale Adumim to the West Jerusalem Al-Quds. The project was first pushed forward by former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Palestinians have slammed the move as seriously dangerous.
Now, as Bennett brings it on the table,
It is just to show the settlers that he's better than Netanyahu. He's continued the main strategy and ideology of the settlements in the West Bank. Netanyahu has been freezing or a little bit slowed down the working in the UN, but they are now pushing it forward. This is a very dangerous colonial project in the West Bank. This will be totally cut off and divided the West Bank between the North and the South. So it's very sensitive, very strategic.
Israeli authorities have been seeking to expel tens of thousands of Palestinian Bedouins to other Palestinian towns since long time ago because the area has been allocated to E1 settlement constructions. This area sits on roughly 15 square kilometers of land northeast of Jerusalem Al-Quds. For years, the Israeli regime has tried to dismantle the Bedouin communities to make way for its massive E1 settlement project in East Jerusalem Al-Quds. The planned Israeli building in E1 would effectively cut the West Bank in half and prevent Palestinian sovereign contiguity between northern and southern West Bank.
The project comes in line with Israel's annexation plan. The new regime in Israel is seeking to disrupt any territorial integrity of a future Palestinian state based on the 1967 borders. To this end, it displaces more Palestinians in violation of all international laws.
Palestinians say that it's very clear that Bennett is even worse than Netanyahu, as he started rapidly to carry out his agenda to expand illegal settlements in the occupied territories even more vigorously.
During Netanyahu's term in office, Israeli-only roads were built as first step in constructing settlements in the controversial E1 zone. Now Bennett has revived the plan and the actual construction for E1. Palestinians warned this project would practically cut the occupied West Bank in half. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
South Africa has been in utter chaos since last Thursday, a day after former President Jacob Zuma handed himself into authorities to serve a 15-month jail term. Zuma was convicted of contempt of court after it defied an order to testify before a judicial commission probing allegations of fraud during his years in office. The former leader's imprisonment sparked protests across much of South Africa. The unrest soon escalated into mayhem. In the past 7 days, more than 800 retail shops and over 200 shopping malls have been looted. Government estimates suggest hundreds of millions of dollars of goods have been purloined or destroyed. That has sparked fears of a looming humanitarian crisis, with authorities warning that parts of South Africa may soon be running short of basic provisions. Analysts believe this could be a further blow to the nation's economy already reeling from the coronavirus pandemic.
What could come out of this, of course, would be even further economic crises in South Africa amid this COVID-19 third wave, which has impacted South Africa more than any other country on the African continent.
The South African Army has already deployed thousands of troops to help overstretched police restore order. That proving insufficient, the government has called another 25,000 Army Reserve troops to tackle the emergency. In addition, people in areas worst hit by the violence have taken up arms and formed vigilante groups to protect their neighborhoods. South Africa is experiencing one of its worst crises since the end of apartheid regime in early 1990s. With the former president in prison, high unemployment, and much of the country plagued by crime, it is hard to imagine an easy path back to normalcy.
South Korea has been hit hard by a fourth wave of the COVID-19 pandemic, with new daily cases over 1,000 for the past week. More than 50% of the recent new cases have been the more contagious Delta variant. The government has issued a number of restrictions and guidelines, including banning gatherings of more than two people, other than family, after 6 p.m.
Please refrain from going out or holding social gatherings and abide by the disinfection guidelines wherever you are. Even if you don't have symptoms, please protect yourself and your loved ones by getting tested. We can and must overcome this crisis. The government will do its best.
Bae Hyung-won and his wife operate a small seafood restaurant in Incheon, just outside of Seoul. He diligently disinfects his restaurant, adhering to social distancing protocols and other government guidelines. He says a lot of businesses in the neighborhood are just hanging on.
The current situation is affecting us tremendously. Up to now, the first to third waves of the coronavirus weren't so bad.
But as soon as the fourth wave started, from the first day, the number of customers plunged by 80 to 90%.
As many countries around the world are now opening up, South Korea is under more pressure from the rest of the public to respond more effectively to the outbreak. Young people have been especially critical, as they will wait months for their shots amid shortages of vaccine supplies. The South Korean government had set a goal of November to achieve herd immunity. Currently, about 12% of the population has been fully vaccinated, while health officials emphasize the importance of the next 2 months in containing the recent wave of infections. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Humanitarian activists gathered outside the Italian parliament to stage a protest against an anti-migration deal between Rome and Tripoli. The protest, dubbed a blindfold to avoid seeing the truth, was called by a number of NGOs ahead of a crucial parliamentary vote on the renewal of the accord. Protesters were saying the deal has been causing suffering to tens of thousands of refugees since its signing in 2017.
Under the deal, Italy helps Libyan maritime authorities to stop boats at sea and return the illegal migrants to detention centers in Libya. At least 50,000 people, including thousands of children, have been returned to the northern African countries so far. However, the condition in Libya is a matter of concern as they face detention and serious abuse, including rape and torture.
I think it's not a problem, unfortunately, only of the Italian government and the country. It's a European problem, and the European policies, basically, Europe endorses the Italian initiative.
During the protest, activists read messages of desperation sent by the refugees trapped in war-ravaged Libya. Some refugees have unsuccessfully attempted to cross the Mediterranean up to 3-4 times.
Facciamo finta di non vedere cosa succede.
We keep turning a blind eye to what is happening in Libya. The decision to renew the deal is a shameful display of how far EU governments are prepared to go to keep refugees and migrants from Europe's shores.
C'è una parte della politica italiana.
Here in Italy, some politicians deal with the migrants as if they were enemies at the gates, creating fear among Italians. The other politicians make sure not to create too much discomfort to their electorate.
Some lawmakers who attended the protest also said that an Italian Navy ship docked in Tripoli has even directly coordinated the intercepting activities carried out on the refugee boats by the Libyan Coast Guard. Later on Wednesday, Foreign Minister Luigi Di Maio told the House that Italy will no more fund the Libyan Coast Guard to encourage a management of migrant flows that is more respectful of international norms by Tripoli. Max Civili, Rome.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Ultimately, Haiti's many problems will only be solved in Port-au-Prince, not Washington.
says Doug Bando, author, in an article published under the heading, The Tragedy of Haiti. Washington should keep its troops at home. Stay tuned for more. The U.S. involvement in Vietnam, Afghanistan, and Iraq were disasters should surprise no one. Social engineering gets harder as differences in history, religion, culture, geography, and politics grow. Yet Washington had ample warning nearer home, having failed to do much better in its own neighborhood, like in Haiti. And a plot apparently involving two Haitian Americans and nearly 30 Colombians, the country's president, Moi, was assassinated. Exactly who wanted him dead and why remains yet unknown. It was a terrible crime. Yet it was a minor blip in the disastrous state of Haitian politics. The assassination added more poison to an already toxic political miasma. Haiti suffers from pervasive corruption, criminal gang activity, violence, and poverty. President Moi faced almost daily demonstrations protesting his politics and practices. Criminal gangs, often used by politicians against their opponents, have killed more than 400 people over the last 3 years. The U.S.-backed president was serving past his term based on dubious legal authority. He was ruling by decree and had cracked down violently on opponents. He was pushing a new constitution that would increase presidential power. His U.S.-backed government failed to hold elections for the Chamber of Deputies last year, allowing its members' terms to expire. Only 10 of 30 senators remain in office. Ma illegally forced several Supreme Court justices from office. The High Court's top judge recently died of COVID-19. Foreign Minister Claude Joseph, interim Prime Minister, claims to be acting president and in charge of the security services. So does Ariel Henry, appointed by Moi to be the new prime minister but not sworn in before Moi's death. Neither Joseph nor Henry has been approved by parliament as required. As Joseph and Henry squabble, the depleted Senate nominated its head as interim president. There are two constitutions, one approved in French and Creole, the author later, one only in French, with conflicting provisions governing presidential vacancies. The country has received $13 billion in foreign aid over the last decade with little impact other than fueling corruption and horror at the assassination only temporarily brought together a badly divided country. In 1994, the Clinton administration threatened to invade Haiti and depose Cedros and his junta, which then ceded power. Alas, the purported return of democracy yielded more instability and violence. A few years later, the Haitian people elected Aristide, both antagonists of the country's rapacious elites, noted advocate of neck-lacing as president, and he was forced from office by a popular revolt. A United Nations stabilization mission followed. In 2006, new elections were held. Over the last decade, an election was delayed by an earthquake. A president was forced from office over fraud allegations. An interim president was chosen. Another election was delayed, in part due to a hurricane, and U.S.-backed Moi was elected. The latter's chaotic reign, governing abuses, and authoritarian approach were fully in line with Haitian political experience. So was the perception of his critics that Washington was meddling and helping prop him up. Only the assassination was a break from the past. Many Haitian presidents left office unwillingly, but they normally survived the experience. treaty's efforts have been constantly exacerbated by outsiders. France's attempt to reconquer the island